The Plot to Kill JFK in Chicago, November 2nd, 1963, by Edwin Black. Investigated by Edwin Black for the Chicago Independent, published November 1975. Foreword. 5 years ago, on commission from the Atlantic Monthly, I began investigating a Chicago conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy just 20 days before Dallas. When I asked the wrong questions and came too close to sensitive information, I was followed and investigated by a defense intelligence operative. By examining my own file, I identified him and embarrassed the DIA into halting the harassment. There is a record of their project in the Credit Bureau where it began. Credit Information Corporation, named Cook County Credit Bureau at the time. The DIA's inquiry listed my employer as Atlantic Monthly, although that assignment was my only work for the magazine. Unfortunately, the harassment didn't end until after my apartment was broken into. No valuables were taken, but all my files were obviously and clumsily searched. But that was 5 years ago, before Watergate, a different era. Today, when reporters edge too close to dirty government secrets, it is the agencies who become nervous, and they think thrice before attempting their retaliation and tactics once common to the game. My investigation revived within the last 8 months, took me to New York, Long Island, Houston, and Washington, as well as through courts, warehouses, police stations, and federal offices in Chicago, hundreds of hours scrutinizing federal and state local documents, dozens of interviews, hundreds of leads, and always with the Secret Service and FBI working against me, doing what they could to make the investigation tedious, time-consuming, and expensive. Perhaps they hoped the investigation would just disappear for all the obstructions. I hope they now know they must come up with the answers. It is simply unacceptable to wait until the 21st century for the release of 70 or so top secret Warren Commission documents. Edwin Black. Part 1. The Scenario. A maze of evidence developed by other journalists and investigators has totally discredited the Warren Commission and its claim that Lee Harvey Oswald, acting alone with no particular motive, assassinated John F. Kennedy on November 22, 1963 in Dealey Plaza. The shabby work of the Commission's investigation, the improper evaluation of ballistics and trajectories, photographic evidence. Any schoolboy can look at the Zapruder film and see that JFK was fatally shot from the right front. So we begin from the assumption that the president was murdered by a conspiracy in Dallas, one which has not yet been precisely detailed, but one which has been clearly outlined. A man's shadow reveals his presence even though his identity is unknown. Our contribution to the ongoing national search for the truth has nothing to do with Dallas, but by indicating a conspiracy in Chicago just shortly before JFK was shot in Texas, a conspiracy which the government preferred to forget, we hope to encourage others with information to step forward. Our work is divided into three sections: scenario, investigation, cover-up. They must be read in order. Don't read one and neglect the others. Don't accept anything you read in this scenario until you have read the investigation of that information and the basis for our conclusions. There are strong indications that four men were in Chicago to assassinate John F. Kennedy on November 2, 1963, 20 days before Dallas. Here's how it happened. November 2, 1963. JFK was scheduled to attend the Army Air Force game at Soldiers Field. Plans called for him to arrive at O'Hare around 11 a.m., motorcade down what was then known as the Northwest Expressway to the Loop. At Jackson, the caravan would lumber up the Jackson exit, make that slow, difficult left-hand turn onto the street, and shuttle over to the stadium. The Jackson exit would be crowded with no fewer than 45 school and civic organizations anxious to see the president. As in Dallas, JFK's limousine would pass through a warehouse district, which Secret Service advanced men would consider 10 times more deadly than any office building corridor. As in Dallas, JFK's limousine would be forced to make a difficult 90-degree turn, which would slow him down to practically a standstill. As in Dallas, JFK's limousine would be forced to make a difficult 90-degree turn that would slow him practically to a standstill. As in Dallas, triangulation of fire would be simple because of the unobstructed view. As in Dallas, the crowd would panic, allowing the assassins to escape unnoticed. Wednesday, October 30th, 3 days before, a coordinating meeting was held in the anteroom to Mayor Daley's fifth-floor City Hall office. Attending were various Secret Service officials, three deputy chiefs of police, and Captain Robert Linsky, the security liaison between the Chicago Police and the Secret Service. As the security plans for Kennedy's visit were mapped, each deputy chief was assigned an air of responsibility. Patrol Deputy Rockford took the airport. Traffic Deputy Maddle took the motorcade route in its precarious passage under those deadly overpasses. Captain Linsky took the Conrad Hilton, the stadium itself, and various street security functions. Mayor Daley's special events man, Jack Riley, stopped in to extend his boss's hope for a safe visit. A few hours after that meeting adjourned, a phone rang in the Chicago office of the Secret Service. Agent Jay Stocks was for a few hours the ranking agent, so he took the call. It was the Federal Bureau of Investigation calling from Washington. The FBI man warned Stocks of a serious and dangerous four-man conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy at the Army-Air Force game. The suspects were right-wing paramilitary fanatics armed with rifles and telescopic sights. The assassination itself would probably be attempted at one of the Northwest Expressway overpasses. This was the information that came from an informant named Lee. Stocks turned to the other people in the office with disbelief, related the information, adding words to the effect that the FBI wasn't sure how to handle the threat. These men were not the typical nuts with a cheap handgun or some irrational score to settle. They were organized, paramilitary assassins. It wasn't a federal crime to kill a president or even to threaten him at the time, and J. Edgar Hoover had decided, since it was the Secret Service's province to protect the president, the FBI would not, could not participate in the investigation. Shortly thereafter, the TWX, or inter-office teletype, clanged out confirmation of the conspiracy from the office of Chief James Rowley, head of the Secret Service in Washington. His instructions were to call every available man in from every other detail and concentrate them in a coordinated blanket investigation to locate the assassins. The teletype added that this would not be an FBI matter, but would be handled strictly by the Secret Service. The buck had officially been passed. The Chicago office was critically understaffed and unprepared for such a crisis. Only 8 men for all assignments, counterfeiting, presidential protection, and so on. So reinforcements were sent in from other offices around the country. Most notable, Myron Weinstein, a crack agent called in from Minneapolis. A break came the next day, Thursday, October 31st. A near-north rooming house landlady telephoned the Chicago police with a tip. 4 men were renting rooms, and in one of them, she observed 4 rifles with telescopic sights. Inasmuch as she knew the president was coming to Chicago in 2 days, perhaps there was some threat here. Would the police look into it? The police immediately informed the Secret Service. Acting agent in charge Maurice G. Martineau scooped up the message and made the connection. This was it. A 24-hour surveillance was set up on the rooming house. Agent J.L. Stocks spotted and followed 2 men fitting the landlady's description, all the time maintaining radio contact with Martineau. Stocks was growing tired when the subject's vehicle headed back to the rooming house in the vicinity of Clark and Division. Stocks, maintaining a discreet distance, followed their car into an alley behind the rooming house. Unfortunately, it was a one-way alley. When suddenly the subjects decided not to park in the alley and turned around to exit, they were forced to squeeze past Stocks' car. Stock saw the men driving his way, tried to maneuver his car around in time, but couldn't. A message came across the radio before Stocks could reach over and turn the volume button down. As the suspects passed Stock's car, they heard the radio message, looked him in the eye, and took off. Stocks reluctantly reported to Martineau that the surveillance was blown before any real evidence could be amassed. Martineau thought, bust them now, with or without evidence. The 2 men were taken into custody, but not actually arrested or booked, in the very early Friday hours and brought to the Secret Service headquarters. There are no records that any weapons were found in their possession or back at the rooming house. The interviews and interrogation conducted by Agent Stocks in the front interrogation office and Agent Robert Motto in the rear interrogation office. Mott's suspect was of large build and extremely large head and mangy hair, wearing a short waist jacket. By 10 a.m., the interviewing agents had coaxed nothing out of their suspect assassins. The only record of their effort was the dozen of half-empty styrofoam coffee cups scattered through the office. When other agents in the office heard of Stocks' rookie error, they couldn't believe it. Every time Stocks emerged from interviewing his suspect, the agents would drop comments, crack jokes, and make fun, blocking the alley on a surveillance. Thomas D. Strong, who fashioned himself above such mistakes, led the ribbing. Over and over again, he took the opportunity to get a little dig, and Stocks hated it. The Patsy. Meanwhile, 2 other agents had been following up a highly suspicious yet bum lead. The man's name was Thomas Arthur Vallée, a 30-year-old ex-Marine, classified extreme paranoid schizophrenic by military doctors. Vallée worked as an apprentice at IPP Lithoplate at 625 West Jackson. As a patsy, he was perfect, as perfect for the Chicago assassination plot as Lee Harvey Oswald was for the Dallas assassination plot. Vallée was born and raised in Chicago. Like Oswald, he joined the Marines in the mid-50s during the Korean War period. Like Oswald, Vallée was assigned to a U-2 base in Japan. Oswald at Camp Atsugi, Vallée at Camp Otsu. The cover reference for the U-2 project at these bases was a joint technical advisory group, JTAG. Since the CIA exerted a strong presence at these two bases, they were prime recruitment stations. Both Vallée and Oswald appear to have been recruited by the CIA for black missions or otherwise unsavory personality discrediting assignments. In Oswald's case, at the height of the Cold War, he was instructed and helped to defect to Russia. With him, he carried top secret radar codes. Oswald's mission, probably unbeknownst to him, may have been to reveal this information for some complex CIA intelligence stratagem. Warren commissioned testimony documents that all these radar codes had been revised because of Oswald's defection. Vallée was recruited about the same time to train members of a fiercely anti-Castro guerrilla group. Objective, the assassination of Fidel Castro. Training locale, in and around Levittown, Long Island. Neither Vallée nor Oswald received money for their clandestine duties. The surreptitious nature of their business was ego-building to their personalities. Inherently rewarding. Both Vallée and Oswald had recently taken jobs in warehouses at the planned assassination sites. Oswald at the 5th floor book depository on Elm Street in Dallas, Vallée in the 3rd floor IPP printing company looking out over Jackson Street exit ramp where Kennedy's limousine would have been hit. Both Vallée and Oswald could be shown to have extremist political views. Both owned rifles. Both were basically loners, basically drifters, basically lowlife. The dregs of society. Perfect for the work they were recruited for, perfect for a frame-up. They even resembled one another physically. Arrested by Daniel Groth. While Agent Stocks was chasing his suspects around town, two other agents were acting on a tip about Thomas Arthur Vallée, a violence-prone John Bircher. Information received accused Vallée of threatening to assassinate Kennedy during his Chicago visit. The source of the tip is unknown. But whoever pointed out Vallée knew his history, his personality, and how law enforcement would react to him. In fact, Vallée had spoken bitterly of JFK, blaming him for pulling the air support off the Bay of Pigs invaders. Quote, "We lost a lot of good men down there," Vallée would say. In his mental state, he may have verbalized death threats against the president. But he does not appear to have been connected to the real threat, four other men referred to in the Secret Service teletype. Problem was, when two Secret Service agents surreptitiously visited Vallée's uptown flea bag at Paulina and Wilson, they observed weaponry that classed Vallée as more than a loudmouth, an M1 carbine, a handgun, and 2,500 rounds of ammunition. With the other members of Chicago's dismally understaffed Secret Service office following other leads, the two agents telephoned Captain Robert Linsky for a 24-hour surveillance on Vallée, requesting he be gotten off the street. Linsky was just about to enter the second special security coordination meeting, this one in the auditorium of the police headquarters at 11th and State. The president was due tomorrow, and Linsky had the massive security task of Soldiers Field, the Conrad Hilton, and the downtown streets to cope with. He made some telephone calls requesting two sharp cops. One of the city's sharpest teams was selected, Daniel Groth and Peter Schirla, both working out of the task force, specifically the pickpocket detail. They were alert, sensitive, street tough, efficient. They took orders like sponges take water. Groth and Schirla dropped everything and whipped over to 11th and State to attend the second security conference. Linsky gave them their instructions. They left the meeting and set out to find Vallée. He hadn't committed any crimes yet. Remember, in those days, threatening a president's life was no specific crime. The gun laws probably allowed him to keep weapons in his home. The surreptitious visiting agents had nothing more on Vallée than a tip. But Groth and Schirla knew their job. Get Vallée off the street. November 2nd, Saturday morning. Groth and Schirla had been tailing Vallée for some time when they decided the moment was right. Vallée's white Ford Falcon was curbed by their unmarked car as he turned west onto Wilson from Damon, heading toward the expressway entrance. Excuse, a left turn without a proper signal. Time, 9 a.m., just 2 hours before Kennedy was scheduled to parade down the Northwest. On Valet's front seat, in open view, a hunting knife. Perfect. Groth charged Valet with unlawful use of a weapon, the knife, and failure to signal a left turn. A search of Valet's person and the front of his car revealed no firearms, but when they opened the trunk, they found 750 rounds of ammunition. Valet had purchased ammunition at the Lawrence Avenue Sears just a short time before. Diem Brothers assassinated. The International Dateline places an imaginary day between Chicago and Saigon. Our November 2nd is their November 1st, and it was very early that Saturday morning, November 2nd, when news hit Chicago. The Diem Brothers, the corrupt rulers of South Vietnam, had been assassinated by a CIA-backed coup, by CIA-sponsored assassins. Obviously, the situation there could no longer be tolerated by a powerful right-wing military faction in America. The Diem Brothers just weren't running an efficient anti-communist campaign. They refused to operate as American powers that be dictated. They were an obstacle. They were eliminated. Method, executive action. Terminate with extreme prejudice. At home, the same powers were frustrated and unbelieving. This JFK must be some sort of traitor. In addition to the civil rights nonsense, the silliness about moving to repeal the oil depletion tax, this traitorous deal with Khrushchev, promising never to invade Cuba, and in so doing, selling out the Cuban people and tactically endorsing Dr. Castro. In addition to all that, this son of a bitch Kennedy was soon to announce that Vietnam was a great mistake for America. This bastard was soon to announce that all our troops would be home by Christmas. First, he sold out Cuba to the Russians, now South Vietnam to the Red Chinese. Like Diem, Kennedy was an obstacle. At the last minute, Captain Linsky was in his downtown office when his phone rang with the notice of Valet's capture. Groth and Sherla had already been escorting Valet to the Damon Avenue police station where he was interrogated about his political views by detectives John Madden and Lawrence Coffey. Valet warned them that the country was in serious trouble unless Barry Goldwater would be elected over Kennedy, and he ranted how only Mayor Richard Daley's crooked machine could ensure Kennedy the ghost votes that he needed to beat the conservative Republican. Madden invited Valet to take them back to his Paulina Street apartment and permit them to search. There was no time for a warrant. The president would be in Chicago in under an hour. When Valet refused, Madden threatened to drag Valet into the back room. Valet chose to open his apartment to their search. Madden and Coffey sped with Valet over to the uptown address, not knowing they were worried about the wrong man. With information supplied by the two Secret Service men, they knew exactly what they were looking for. They seized Valet's M1, his matched carbine, and 2,500 rounds, all purchased in New York. Valet was transported to the 20th District, where he was locked up during the hours that President Kennedy was expected to be in town. Back at Secret Service headquarters, Motto and Stock still couldn't break their suspected conspirators. The minutes were counting down till Kennedy's arrival at O'Hare. Less than an hour away, and still the two remaining conspirators, if they existed, couldn't be found, couldn't be traced. The two suspects pinched the day before remained in custody, while Motto and Stock hit the streets. Motto raced over to Soldiers Field, checking the area around Kennedy's seats. Two sections were reserved for him, one on the Air Force side and the second on the Army side. The president was scheduled to change sides during halftime. Word from Washington. The assassination of the Diem brothers shocked Kennedy and his close advisors, but the Chicago visit would not be canceled. Instead, Pierre Salinger announced at 9:30 a.m. a special communications facility would be rush-constructed under Soldiers Field bleachers to keep the president informed on up-to-the-minute developments in the coup-torn South Vietnam. He reiterated Kennedy would not cancel the trip. But developments in downtown Chicago apparently were far more threatening than what was going on in Saigon. Two men were in custody in Secret Service headquarters. This Thomas Arthur Valet character was in custody, his weapons confiscated, but if the original FBI information was accurate, two of the four alleged conspirators were still at large, probably armed, and they were not frenzied maniacs racing across hallways or intersections with cheap pistols in their hands. They were cool, militarized assassins, identity completely unknown, waiting somewhere in Chicago with loaded rifles. JFK cancels. 10:15, Saturday, November 2nd. People in Washington, aware of the unsettled security problem in Chicago, absolutely refuse to allow the president to fly to Chicago. The visit is canceled at the very last moment. The press corps jet has even taken off. The excuse? Kennedy had to stay close to developments in Southeast Asia. Phones rang in Chicago bringing the news of JFK's cancellation. This was unheard of. No notice at all? Someone hired sound trucks to cruise up and down the motorcade route announcing the cancellation over loudspeakers to the waiting crowds. Mayor Daley was picked. Thousands more who had lined up in the streets, especially on Jackson Boulevard, were thoroughly disappointed. But a handful of agents and investigators were intensely relieved. The two suspects could no longer be held without an iota of evidence. They were released from Secret Service custody. However, the shadow of the assassins followed JFK wherever he went from that moment on. An identical warning of an assassination conspiracy was teletyped to New Orleans office by the FBI just before Kennedy's planned visit there, November 17th. A copy of the teletype was recently acquired by CBS News and televised along with an interview by the man on duty when it came across. That plot was probably assigned to a second team. There was no record of any New Orleans arrests, but obviously the plot was either neutralized or aborted for some reason. It didn't stop JFK from safely visiting New Orleans. It also didn't stop him from visiting Dallas. November 22nd, just 20 days after Chicago, as he drove over the most precarious of routes through a warehouse district on Elm Street that had not been covered by Secret Service advance men, as the motorcade lumbered to a fatal pause in Dealey Square, shots split through the cheering crowd. Kennedy's head exploded into tremendous bloody bits. They finally got him. Part 2. The Investigation. Obviously, the information related to Chicago Independent by numerous sources and pieced together in the preceding scenario was shocking. Every word of the scenario is predicated on information gained from documents and interviews. All the documents were double-checked for authenticity. All the interviews were compared to other independently gained information. Where individual claims they would not either be substantiated or discredited, the sources were subjected to either polygraph or voice stress analysis to indicate truthfulness. There is no supposition except in one area. We know Thomas Arthur Vallee was arrested and his background is accurately described. However, we have no way of knowing that the people behind the conspiracy to kill JFK actually set Vallee up as a fall guy, as Oswald was set up as a patsy in Dallas. We do not know who supplied the original information leading to Vallee's arrest. We speculate the conspirators were behind it. Now follows a complete documentation and investigative profile of all the information in the scenario. Documenting anything in the conspiracy to assassinate John F. Kennedy is practically impossible. Worse, theoretical, often false statements have a way of reinforcing themselves and slowly transforming into the truth in the eyes of the investigator. Problems. 1. The biggest problem is sources. Most of them are insane, emotionally disturbed, seeking attention, or unreliable because of their illicit activities. Number 2. Key sources in a position to confirm or deny critical information are often dead. Not necessarily because of some grand conspiracy wanted to cross off every viable witness. There is good reason to suspect the deaths of 90 important witnesses in rapid succession during the first few years following the assassination. Generally, they died under bizarre circumstances, frequently suicide, usually on the day they were supposed to render some important testimony or deposition to an investigative body. But in the Chicago plot, at least the people died from ordinary circumstances, most of them during the past 5 years. Number 3. Reporters have distorted the facts to sell newspapers. Assassination theories make great headlines. Unfortunately, follow-up for authenticity is scarce. Number 4. Most of the routine documents, such as flight tickets, arrest reports, weapon receipts, and so on, have been destroyed, either intentionally or because of normal purging procedures. Number 5. The government is covering up the facts, specifically the FBI and the Secret Service, not because they are in on the plot, but because they botched protection of the president and the investigation of his assassins. They are covering up their own stupidity, their own ineptitude. The disclosures about threatening letters Oswald delivered to the FBI 10 days before the assassination are now only surfacing. An agent has admitted destroying the evidence just hours after the killing of JFK in Dallas. Former FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's closest aide, William Sullivan, is quoted by Time magazine as claiming 10 top FBI officials, including himself, were ordered to withhold information about the Oswald threat from the already misguided, bluffable Warren Commission investigators. In any man's book, such cover-ups are accessory to murder after the fact. The one single foremost guiding principle we pursued in this investigation was trust no source. Trust no document, trust no government official, trust no eyewitness, trust nothing until it has been so severely challenged it could not be discredited. Our main source. Our main supply of information was one of the Secret Service agents on duty at the time of the conspiracy. In cooperating with us, he broke the old boy system of the Secret Service and regulations forbidding press contacts among individual agents. His terms, total anonymity. His motives, a desire to set the record straight. We agreed. He's afraid that if his cooperation were uncovered by the Secret Service or the FBI, they would move against him in small but powerful ways, as organizations can do to their disloyal. They can make life very difficult, he explains. To verify his information, our source agreed to submit to a polygraph test, as long as he could do so without being discovered. An unlogged appointment was arranged with John E. Reed and Associates, the most respected lie detection and polygraph service in the nation. Under an assumed name, our man flew in from the East Coast to O'Hare, where he was met, then shuttled to the loop. The polygraph technician interviewed our man for about 45 minutes, then conducted actual polygraph examinations for about 30 minutes. Our man was tested for his knowledge of the original teletype he claims was received by Secret Service in Chicago, warning of a four-man conspiracy. His knowledge that the informant's code name was Lee. His knowledge of Secret Service agent J.L. Stock's surveillance and the suspected assassin's discovery of that surveillance and related information. The test was inconclusive. Reed's tester explained that 15-20% of the subjects examined must return for a second shorter test before their truthfulness can be certified. He added that deceit is generally quite easy to detect, especially among law enforcement personnel, who already bear an emotional respect for the polygraph. And in our man's case, the lie detector didn't come close to the deceit range, but did fall just short of the total truthfulness range, requiring the second shorter session. The Reed Laboratory panel of experts explained that these indefinite tests are generally due to subtle doubts in the subject's mind. For this reason, polygraph questions are structured with extreme care. Reed's panel ventured that the subtle doubt could be regarding the date October 30th. Our man remembered it more as Wednesday before the president's Saturday visit rather than October 30th. In fact, when the Reed examiner detected the indefinite response, he queried our man about any doubts. Our man replied that only the specific date October 30th troubled him. Unfortunately, because our man had been interviewed and tested in a tiny cubicle for nearly 1.5 hours, he was psychologically unsuitable for additional testing at that time. Testing which would have repeated the questions in a different phrasing to ignore the date and concentrate on the main issue, the teletype itself. After the test, the Reed panel pleaded with us to somehow return for a second, short 20-minute test. That's all they'd need to positively certify our man's truthfulness, assuming he was telling the truth. It was painful to tell them that it was impossible. Persuading our source to go as public as flying to Chicago and submitting to a polygraph examination was extremely difficult. He's already gone through a lot in his attempts to bring details of the Chicago plot to light. Regretfully, we can't expose that entire story here, lest we identify our source. His wife and family were against the polygraph. His minister was against it. His best friend was against it. He was against it. He projected that the lie test would be just the first step. More testing, then grand juries, Senate subcommittees, reporters, and more reporters would eventually follow. His life and his family's life would become public property. The sole basis under which he finally consented after long appeals was that the single test be his last involvement. From then on, it would be up to the rest of the country to scratch away at the facts. We promised him that under no circumstances would we let any other investigative body get near him. There would be no additional tests. John E. Reed's tester even agreed to meet our man in a neutral spot, such as a motel room. Certifying his truthfulness was very important to the Polygraph Institute, especially in the light of our man's far-reaching disclosures. But our source would not come in again. He wouldn't even discuss it. Checking out our sources' version of the events at the Secret Service office just before JFK's November 2nd visit involved tracking men and documents. We began at the south side home of court archivist Sherman Skolnick. Skolnick, whose local reputation had suffered within the past few years, at one time had an admirable score of direct hits against corrupt politicians and judges. It was Skolnick who began the investigation into Otto Kerner's racetrack deals. Skolnick had developed some leads on the Thomas Arthur Vallee arrest years ago that never went beyond the question mark stage. He even filed a Freedom of Information Act suit against the government to release more facts. He was ignored. It was 2 a.m. on a Saturday night as we drank coffee and reviewed documents in his possession that at least proved there was a man named Thomas Arthur Vallee. The Secret Service was concerned about him, and Dan Groth and Peter Sherla of the Chicago Police had arrested him. I took copies with me. Records are gone. Next step was to scour local records. We discovered that Judge Walter J. Kowalski's Rackets Court was one of the several handy depositories for security risks like valet or perhaps any of the four men. In those days, federal agents without enough evidence for a federal warrant would drag suspects into a cooperative judge's courtroom. Some trump charge would be entered, say disorderly conduct, reckless driving, or vagrancy, just enough to keep the man off the streets. Then, depending on the judge's demeanor that morning, he would order a suspended sentence, a fine, or dismissal. In a warehouse on Lake Street and in Civic Center storage rooms, the county preserves all the old dockets, court records from 10, 15, 20 years back. Each docket is encased in a massive 30-pound ledger. After 2 days of searching for Kowalski's November 2, 1963 docket, we finally found it. Vallee's name and charge was located. In addition, we checked out the records of every other defendant during the 3 or 4 days in question. Dozens of good leads, no other results. Then we checked every arrest in the entire city on those days. Who arrested them? Why? Any weapons? It took weeks. In the process, we developed leads. Look for Cuban names. Look for the name Bradley. Look for the name Braden. Nothing came of it. Well, if Valley was the only one arrested, maybe arrest records were the wrong route. Let's think about the weapons. All weapons are inventoried when seized. The crime lab routinely tests them and issues a weapons receipt. We found the confidential weapons inventory records. Valet rifles were registered, so were the other long guns, but it was impossible to identify them without corresponding receipts. When we went looking for the receipts, we discovered they had been routinely destroyed several years ago. Working against us was not a conspiracy, but a bureaucracy. It was impossible to cope with. Tracking motto and stocks. Still, we did have some documents to show. With them, we might convince a few agents to cooperate. We'd have to track down the original group, who had moved several times from city to city in the intervening years. First, a word about background. We are told Secret Service men possess remarkably good memories, especially when it concerns major conspiracies or other important crimes. Furthermore, we are told that while serious, elaborate conspiracies are rather commonplace in the counterfeiting business, which the Secret Service investigates, they are quite uncommon with regard to protection of a president. Most threats against presidents are from basically unorganized, emotional, frenzied individuals, easy to locate and put away, not conspiracies. Secret Service men who have served protection detail for presidential visits generally recall the incidents clearly. In particular, November of 1963 was, of course, the fateful month for the Secret Service. In talking to agents and former agents, I perceived their special awareness of where they were at the time of the assassination and how they helped protect JFK on any immediate preceding visits, including the planned November 2nd appearance. One of the most important men to contact was J. Lloyd Stocks, the man said to have first received the phone call from Washington about the four-man assassination conspiracy, and the man who later conducted and blundered surveillance of the two suspects in the alley. We tracked Stocks' movement within the Secret Service from the Chicago office to Kansas City office to the Detroit office where he is today. I located Stocks at his home in Detroit area. In a telephone interview, Stocks recalled the planned November visit, but hedged on the subject of conspiracy. At first, he claimed to remember something about a guy called Vallee. Then he stopped himself and recited, "All I can say is I have no specific recollection one way or the other. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, I just don't remember." Pressed as to whether he flubbed the surveillance of two of the four suspects, thus incurring the general office ribbing in the next day, he answered with irritation, "I just can't remember one way or the other."
"You'll have to call Washington for more information." We were eager to challenge our informant's information about Stocks and told him so. urged him to think about it and please indicate whether our story was false. Stock said he could have no more comment. Next, we tracked Robert Motto, the man said to have interviewed one of the two suspected conspirators November 1st in the Secret Service office. Motto retired from the Secret Service several years ago, but still lives in Chicago. After checking, we located him working as an investigator for the Cook County Public Administrator's Office, handling probate cases. A meet was arranged in a parked car at Diversey and Broadway. Motto well recalled the planned November 2nd visit. He affably told where he was November 2nd, checking seats in Soldiers Field, and related other details. But when the question of conspiracy came up, Motto also suffered a memory lapse. Gee, I'd like to help you. For all I know, maybe there was something like that. I just can't be sure. I have nothing to be afraid of. The Secret Service can't touch me. My pension is in. But I just don't recall. Well, yes or no, did he interview a suspect? I wish I could remember. I just can't. Documents from D.C. Initial leads were turning up all dry. We would have been happy to disprove our sources' information, but all the I can't remembers were just too convenient. It's easy enough for a man to say, no, that never happened, when you're asking if he was investigating a major assassination plot, so something was there. I called a friend in Washington, D.C., who knew a lot about Secret Service and FBI records and filing systems. He would help me gain access to some original files and reports relating to the Warren Commission. The next flight to Washington was in 45 minutes. I was on it. I began going through the documents at 10 a.m. There were thousands of them, about 1,550 separate reports, each one anywhere from a single page to hundreds of pages. Many of these have been classified for years. Hour after hour, I studied the FBI and Secret Service approach to presidential protection and investigation of threats. The striking feature was the incredible diligence, the incredibly exhaustive level investigation. A telling example of Chicago investigations, someone had heard a rumor that their homosexual boyfriend had slept with Oswald several weeks before the assassination. An agent worked day and night tracing the source of the rumor. From homosexual to homosexual until 7 persons later, he located the source. A bisexual who claimed he had really remarked, wouldn't it have been nice to sleep with Oswald? Even more exemplary, a girl reports her friend who works at Cokesbury Bookstore in Wabash Street recalls talking to a strange customer a few days before JFK was murdered. The strange man was an avid fan of science fiction paperbacks. On the day in question, he remarked that Martians were likely to invade Earth and assassinate all world leaders. Presumably, that included Kennedy. No fewer than a dozen interviews were conducted. When the customer was finally located, he admitted he enjoyed science fiction and really wasn't predicting such a worldwide catastrophe as much as relating an interesting storyline he'd read somewhere. On and on, the investigations of kooks nuts. Then Oswald Ruby. Interviews with anyone they'd ever known. Every phone call they'd made for 6 months before Dallas. Every check they'd ever received. In depth, leaving nothing to guesswork, exhaustive. Then I happened on some reports of the valet incident. The reports were strangely second-hand, based on a single surreptitious visit of the Secret Service agents to his apartment and police accounts. His weapons were never checked. The serial numbers were never checked to see if they were in sequence with any others uncovered in the Dallas investigation. Valet himself was not interviewed about his possible connections to anything in the Dallas investigation. Unlike the homosexual, the science fiction lover, unlike anyone else of the thousands that came to the attention of the Secret Service as they investigated Jack Kennedy's murder. They didn't even ask the routine question they asked all potential threats. Where were you on November 22nd? They merely reported that his employers claimed valet was in Chicago on November 22nd, a statement those sources later denied to me. Why? Why was everything being cut short in the valet case? What were they afraid to find? It was late, about 9:30 at night. My eyes hurt. I stretched them to stay awake. I hadn't moved from the little table where I was sitting for nearly 12 hours. There was nothing more in valet anywhere. There were 3 strange top-secret memos regarding Lee Harvey Oswald dated in Chicago that I couldn't get my hands on. Other than that, zero. Nothing on any conspiracy of 4 men, and records that were more important to me than anything on valet, especially since he was probably a side issue. Then just at the end, I almost glossed over it. Unlabeled, just a few terse sentences without elaboration. 10 days after the Dallas assassinations, FBI agents in Chicago paid a discreet visit to Jose Mills, a Mexicana ticket agent in O'Hare Airport. The question, on Flight 800, November 1st, did a foreigner named Lee Marvin fly from Mexico City to Chicago? The answer, no.
but one M. Lee and one R. Martin were passengers on that flight. Lee Harvey Oswald used many aliases, a favorite of which was O. H. Lee. Second question. On Flight 800, November 12th, did a foreigner named Wilfred Oswalt fly from Mexico City to Chicago? Answer, no, but a J. Oswalt was a passenger on that flight. O-S-W-A-S-L-T. Oswalt. On the second sheet, a report dated the same day, Ernest R. Tobin, an immigration inspector at O'Hare, was asked how the I-94 forms required of all such entering aliens could be examined. Tobin told the agents where to find them. But the file indicates they never looked. They never tried to locate Lee or Marvin or the man known as Oswalt. Later we checked with immigration. If the FBI or Secret Service had followed up that week, they could have traced M. Lee, R. Martin, and J. Oswalt. Now those I-94 forms have been added to the master file, organized alphabetically, not by date or flight number. It's virtually impossible to locate a single name without more detailed personal data from the tens of millions of I-94 names listed. Seeing this after all those exhaustive investigations, it appears someone asked the wrong questions, received right answers, and decided they didn't want to know any more. A similar federal investigation pattern was to reappear over and over again throughout the next decade until in Watergate someone got caught. Obviously, the FBI didn't want to uncover any complications. Why should they? Oswalt was clean and neat. Leave it alone. I took the last flight out of Washington back to Chicago. Ken Lynch and Tom Call Stonewallet. The next morning, I turned to Thomas D. Strong, the man who reportedly led the office ribbing the morning after Stocks muffed the surveillance. We traced Strong to an intelligence unit of the Secret Service. We were expecting him to return our call when the telephone rang with Ken Lynch at the other end. Who is Ken Lynch? He is a Secret Service agent assigned to deal with unpleasant media inquiries. He insisted that Strong would not make any comment to us about any possible assassination plot against JFK, but could we give him the details? We did, and he promised to contact Strong and with a day or two respond in the following manner. And we quote, "If the teletype and conspiracy existed, we'll answer truthfully that it did, if we can. If it did not exist, we will of course immediately inform you that it did not. If the teletype and or this conspiracy did exist, but for some reason I wouldn't be permitted to discuss it with you, rather than lie to you and say it didn't, I would merely respond, no comment. That's our procedure around here." Shortly before that, we had filed a Freedom of Information action to gain access to the teletype in question and other documents relating to the surveillance and custody. Soon after, we were contacted by Freedom of Information officer Robert Goff, who claimed the Secret Service could locate no records that might confirm or deny the existence of any such teletype warning of a Chicago conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy. Nor could the Secret Service find records of Stocks' surveillance or the interrogation of two suspects by Stocks and Motto. Nor could they determine if Agent Thomas D. Strong had joked about the foiled surveillance the next day. I asked Goff if anyone had actually contacted Stocks, Motto, or Strong to check the information. Somewhat embarrassed, he answered, "Well, actually, no one had contacted them." "No." I came back, "Then how the hell do you know it isn't possible to determine if the surveillance or interrogation occurred?" Goff mumbled something, sputtered, then blurted, "Well, that's all I can say. We're not going to give you the information, so you may as well give up." We scurried back to Ken Lynch, remember? The guy who would tell us the truth unless he couldn't, in which case he would reply no comment. Lynch delivered his official response to our inquiry. No comment on anything. "Can't you even tell me if we're right or wrong, if this teletype exists?" He repeated his frozen answer. At one point, we demanded a reason for the no comment. Lynch retorted, "Here's one reason. There's a Freedom of Information Act inquiry on the entire subject, and therefore we cannot divulge any information." "Who submitted the inquiry?" "Sorry," he came back, "I can't discuss that." "Wait a minute. You're not by any stretch of the imagination referring to my own FOI action, are you?" "Actually, I am," Lynch answered. Incredulous, I told him, I had already been turned down by my request. And even if I hadn't, what difference did it make? I was the same person seeking the same documents, whether through a press inquiry or through a Freedom of Information action. Lynch seemed a bit startled to learn I'd already been turned down by my FOI reaction. "Really?" he said. "But I was told we were still studying how we would respond to you." No decision has been made. After that last slip, however, Ken Lynch declared he had nothing more to say, period. We tried the FBI, the agency said to have originated the conspiracy information through their informant named Lee. Here was a serious hole in our source's story. As everyone in law enforcement and the intelligence community knows, informants are never given name codes, only number codes. So why was the FBI's informant in this conspiracy name coded? Even our own man thought this was illogical. An unofficial source of ours in the FBI explained why once in a great while, non-numerical codes are assigned to informants. All Secret Service and FBI informants routinely receive a numbered code such as 834. The service or bureau maintains an extensive file on each such informant, identifiable by a number code only. However, it's not difficult for any federal intelligence agent to discover the identity of such an informant through a cross-index which lists the number-coded informants and their true identities. This cross-index is supposed to be secret. Therefore, once in a great while, an informant is so highly placed, so vital, or so vulnerable, he is assigned a non-numeral code. His identity is known only to his control in the bureau or service. Such was the case with an informant known only as D, whose classified testimony about Lee Harvey Oswald and the American Embassy in Mexico was only recently revealed through a Freedom of Information Act suit. This thinking may have also been the case with Lee, the man or woman supplying the information on the Chicago assassination plot. For an official response, we contacted the official Washington smokescreener, Agent Thomas B. Call, in charge of press relations. Call at first refused to check our claim, denying that the FBI originated the Chicago conspiracy tip. I kept asking how he knew this for a fact without checking. He finally blurted out, because I remember that case. Some people were picked up, and I'm telling you it wasn't ours. And that was strictly a Secret Service affair. That whole Soldiers Field matter was a Secret Service affair. When pressed on specific knowledge of the Chicago plot, Call grunted, "You'll get no more out of me. I've said as much as I'm going to get on that subject. Now get the rest from the Secret Service." Robert Linsky remembers, "Having been stonewalled and no commented by everyone we contacted in the Secret Service and FBI, we turned to local sources. First on the list was Robert Linsky. We found him working as a supervisor with Burns Security in Evergreen Plaza. After the police tavern shakedowns that scandalized his entire unit and sent many of his direct subordinates to jail, Linsky resigned. Linsky was reluctant to talk, but finally consented to a taped sit-down in his far south side office. Linsky remembered the planned November 2nd JFK visit. He supplied information about the security meetings in the mayor's office and the police headquarters auditorium, and he confirmed information we had developed on the events leading to Thomas Arthur Vallee's arrest from the Secret Service request to the selection and assignment of arresting Chicago police officers Groth and Sherla to the actual surveillance and arrest of Vallee. The only area in which his information on Vallee failed was in the ammunition found in the automobile. He refused to believe that 750 rounds of ammo were recovered, even after we showed him federal documents to prove it. While Linsky supplied much information about the security in general, and Vallee in particular, he denied any knowledge whatsoever about a four-man conspiracy. He said, "For all I know, there could have been such a conspiracy, but I wasn't in a position to be aware of it." Linsky maintained his position no matter how hard we pressed. Later, the interview tape was subjected to psychological stress evaluation, voice stress analysis, which is a lie detector technique analogous to the polygraph. While John E. Reed's machine measures respiration and blood pressure, the PSE measures micro tremors in the voice, which are affected in much the same way when a person is deceitful. Anthony Pelicano Associates, a nationally recognized voice stress expert located in Westchester, subjected the Linsky interview tape to PSE and judged his responses to be truthful. Groth and Sherla get nervous. Next stop, Dan Groth, Peter Sherla. Very touchy. You see, Dan Groth has quite a name in Chicago. A few years after this sharp cop had done the Secret Service a favor by getting Vallee off the streets, he kicked down Fred Hampton's apartment door, and 99 bullets later and two Black Panther leaders were massacred, which many claim was another favor, this one to the FBI. In fact, Groth has repeatedly been accused of being some sort of CIA or intelligence operative brought out of the deep freeze for special assignments when necessary. He has even been taken to court by a number of legal activists who claim that Groth and the other state's attorney raiders at dawn were really pulling a deadly dirty trick, black mission, whatever euphemism you call it, for the CIA or FBI, and they've predicated these suits on Groff's save-the-day involvement in the valet affair. The claim? If Groff wasn't a special federal agent, why would he, of all people, have been chosen to pinch valet? In fairness to Dan Groff, there's been no substantiation to these charges beyond rhetoric and supposition. In the process, however, Groff has transformed from a cool, tough cop to a nervous pity of a man. His hair has grayed considerably, his family life has been ruined, he's run out of answers for his children, he works 2 full-time jobs a day to pay off massive legal bills in excess of $17,000. The valet affair has been enmeshed in suspicion because Groff and Shirla, either on assumed or expressed orders from the federal government, covered up the exact nature of the valet arrest. Valet's arrest report indicated nothing about 750 rounds of ammunition, and Groff and Shirley have repeatedly denied arresting valet for anything more than a turn signal violation, even though the words M1 rifle appear incongruously at the top of the right-hand corner of the arrest report. Groff has always dismissed that as a freak typo. Groff was once a very good source of mine. During the height of the Black Panther raid controversy, he granted me exclusive interviews. But when I contacted this time, he accused me of plotting against him. In a coffee shop across from the Chicago Avenue police station where he works, Groff and I tried to negotiate terms for conveying information. He rejected any and all guarantees of anonymity or confidentiality. But he did end the discussion with this telling emotional outburst. "Damn it, I had the weight of my country on my shoulders when I went out to arrest valet. Why is everyone trying to make me out a son of a bitch now?" I had no better luck with Shirla. While he hadn't suffered the stigma Groff had, since Shirla was not a part of that infamous state's attorney raiding party, he was still extremely jittery. This valet business has brought him to the attention of legal activists who knew fragments of the valet story and had subpoenaed him to testify, trying to prove his former partner was CIA. That meant legal fees for Shirla as well, so Shirla refused to acknowledge one word. Until one day I visited him in his office on the 8th floor of the police headquarters. Oh yes, Shirla had gone up in the world, now part of Chicago's massive police intelligence apparatus. I sneaked into the 8th floor complex where all the surveillance photos are developed and confronted Shirla personally. Up until the time we had conversed only on the phone, before Shirla had a chance to back away, I fired the facts at him. He looked at me nervously and admitted, "Okay, you got all that information, you got the valet story, go ahead, print it." I thanked him for his permission. Coffey confirms details. We received greater cooperation from Sergeant Lawrence Coffey, who with his partner Sergeant James Madden interrogated valet, searched valet's uptown apartment, and seized rifles. Madden died a few years before, but Coffey's memory was one of the most helpful. "Naturally, I remember every detail," he said. "How often is anyone involved in a threat against the president's life? One involving a lot of heavy weapons like this valet character." Coffey supplied most of the details quoted in our scenario about Valley's interrogation. He ended his recollection with the statement, "You know, with the president being murdered like that just a few weeks later in Dallas, I often wondered if Valley had anything to do with it. But I suppose the Secret Service talked to this guy and checked him out pretty thoroughly. Ruled it out, huh?" I answered, "No, you and your partner were the only law enforcement people to interrogate Valley. They didn't even contact him after the assassination to check on his weapons or associations." Coffey shrugged and capped, "I wonder what that means." Undercover in Houston. The last step was to locate Valet himself. Shortly after 1963, Valet drifted to Indianapolis, where he found a good-paying printing job. Confidential Secret Service records we examined showed that when he moved, the Chicago office forwarded his file to Indianapolis. A few years later, he moved on again, this time to Columbus. Once again, the file was forwarded to the next city. His file also reveals that in the fall of 1966, the Secret Service conducted its first interrogation of Valet. Agent Manpal called him in for questioning about his rifle serial numbers. Apparently, Valet had quickly replaced the weapons that Coffey and Madden had confiscated. The file sections we saw did not indicate exactly why Manpal was checking Valet's new weapons, but one Secret Service source reported it involved a subsequent threat by Valet against a Secret Service protectee, perhaps LBJ. But even then, not a single question was raised about Valet's 1963 activities in Chicago. Recently, Valet again drifted, this time to Houston. His Secret Service file did not list his current address, but by checking with a source in the Texas Department of Motor Vehicles, we determined that Valet had applied for a driver's license just a few months ago, and was now living in the rural outskirts of Houston. Survey of printers turned up a place of his employ. A few weeks ago, my barber gave me a crew cut, and then I boarded a Braniff jet for Houston. I carried nothing more than my toothbrush and some tape recording equipment. I would pose as a right-wing reactionary, which some of my friends joked required no pretending. My name would be Eddie Brokaw. My objective, to coax out of valet all the details of the incident surrounding JFK's planned November 2nd, 1963 visit. Valet's place wasn't far from the airport. He lived in a ramshackled mobile home park. A guard dog chained to his door kept visitors away. I waited down the highway for his VW van to pass on his way home from work. It was 7 p.m. when I knocked at his door. Restraining the dog with one hand, holding a rosary in the other, he answered and then invited me in. It was a dump. Just a shabby sofa, a discarded coffee table, and a few chairs in the trailer's front room. The cooking area was piled up with dishes, half-empty cans and packages, garbage spilling out of bags. His bedroom was simply two mattresses, not even sheets. Cigarette butts and ash heaps littered over everything. An oiled and polished M1 leaned up against his mattress, a high-powered hunter's crossbow visible underneath. A Springfield rifle was stored elsewhere in the trailer. I explained that Eddie Brokaw was part of some imaginary clandestine group. I called it Special Operations Group. I was recruiting riflemen for a special operation involving Cuba, but first I would have to check his security rating, which meant rehashing all the details of the 1963 episode. I made it clear the entire account must be taped, which we would then subject to voice stress analysis to determine his truthfulness. The entire matter appealed to Valet, and he was happy to join. I began with the simple question, what happened November 2, 1963? He answered quickly and curtly, Soldiers Field, the plot against John F. Kennedy. I was arrested. He then supplied confirming details about his whereabouts, the arrest, the interrogation, the weapons, the ammunition, where he purchased them, and his political beliefs about JFK and Mayor Daley. His staccato account was punctuated with stereotypical military cliches such as negative, affirmative, and niner for the number nine. But while Valet admitted to everything about the guns and his whereabouts, he patently denied he actually threatened the president or even considered doing him any harm. Valet claimed he was framed. Framed because with his openly anti-Kennedy sentiments, he could easily be believed to have threatened the president. Framed by someone with special knowledge about him. It seemed the first information about Valet identified his middle name as Patrick. His middle name was actually Arthur, but he once used the middle name Patrick to enlist at an early age in the Marine Corps. He also gave specifics about his CIA assignment to train exiles to assassinate Castro. He confirmed that he was never called before the Warren Commission or even interviewed by the Secret Service on anything until 1966. Even Valet thought that was remiss on general principles. His information checked out with everything we had compiled independently. And when we voice-stressed the tape, we found his account to register truthful. Although truthfulness is difficult, if not impossible, to accurately gauge, even within the normal margin of error, when the subject is so far from reality that he may believe his own fabrications to be the purest truth, yet, if Valet was just a lone nut who wasn't dangerous to anyone, and if our investigation wasn't turning up anything substantial, why is it that while I was talking to Valet in Houston, a Chicago Secret Service agent named Tom Hampton was discreetly investigating Eddie Brokaw? Hampton called our office, identified himself, and asked if we employed a reporter named Eddie Brokaw and could we furnish any information on him. Hampton was told his call would be returned. When I arrived back in Chicago, I was told of Hampton's inquiries. I called him and asked how he knew Eddie Brokaw was a reporter for the Chicago Independent, when Eddie Brokaw had only come into existence a few days before and then in an undercover role. Hampton snapped back, "Well, he's been asking a lot of sensitive questions, and we want to know why." Speed is a quality the Secret Service learned was indispensable after the assassination of the president. Compiling the scenario. By playing one man's information off against another's, by comparing reactions to accusations, by the use of voice stress analysis and the polygraph, not as foolproof evidence, but merely as a good gauge within limitations, by document, analysis, and other means, we were able to piece together the scenario, a scenario which has not been contradicted or even criticized by either the authorities or the principal players alleged to have taken part. No comments, memory lapses, yes, but specific details or contradictions, not one. In fact, the more pieces we put together, the more reluctant the Secret Service or FBI people were. If that was any barometer of reliability of our sources, then the scenario we recounted is accurate. And so, without using the word proof, we repeat, there are strong indications there were four men in Chicago to assassinate John F. Kennedy November 2nd, 1963, 20 days before Dallas. Part 3, the cover-up. Looking at all the events in perspective, we can easily see who covered up and why. Remember that in 1963, presidential protection was disorganized. Under the law, among federal agencies, after the assassination, the various agencies squabbled over exactly who would take charge of the investigation. Secret Service, FBI, CIA, City of Dallas, State of Texas. Finger-pointing and buck-passing escalated into a race to avoid blame for the president's death under the flimsiest of security precautions conceivable. So, of course, no one wanted it known that prior to the Dallas trip, there had been high alerts, reasons for special caution. Otherwise, how does it look that the Secret Service routed Kennedy through the most physically obvious of traps, with his bubble top down, in the hostile Dallas environment, and even then, not securing the warehouses as they customarily do? So, of course, no one wants to admit that teletypes warned of serious assassination conspiracies throughout the month of November. In New Orleans, on the 17th, documented by CBS. In Chicago, on the 2nd of the month. No one wants to admit that the FBI conveyed advanced tips about these conspiracies. But then, under orders from J. Edgar Hoover, who bitterly hated the Kennedy brothers, it didn't lift a finger to stop it. Even today, you can call Thomas B. Cole of the FBI in Washington, and you'll hear the bitter rivalry and buck-passing. Listen to him as he coldly defends the FBI's right to do nothing about presidential threats because of something Cole calls jurisdiction. Even today, you can call Ken Lynch of the Secret Service in Washington and listen to him coldly ignore the fact that the FBI destroyed the threat Oswald delivered 10 days before the assassination. He'll say, "That's the FBI's problem, not ours. Talk to them about it." Why doesn't one agency go after the other when these disclosures come out? Or is it that all of them are in bed together, and only if everyone covers up can they all avoid exposure? If you approach that problem with the Cold War government mentality of dirty tricks, cover stories, cover-ups, evidence destruction, you can see why the whitewash investigation of what really happened during the month of November 1963 was just another of the misdeeds of that era. The Bay of Pigs, the attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro, mafia murder contracts, break-ins, mail interceptions, the assassination of the DM brothers on November 1st. Why should JFK's murder be any different? Begin in Chicago, November 2nd. First, the Secret Service launches an all-out investigation against a four-man conspiracy, blows to surveillance, and can't crack two of the suspects. Then comes the second tip about Thomas Arthur Vallee. But wait a minute. A quick check of Vallee's past with the CIA shows his involvement in anti-Castro assassination squads in Long Island. Back off. Get this nut off the street, but don't squeeze him too hard. We wouldn't want that embarrassing information leaked out. So just have the local police pinch the guy. We don't even want to talk to him. A few days after Kennedy leaves Chicago, Vallee and everyone else will feel better. The Chicago police oblige by covering up any information about weapons and ammunition. Somewhere along the way, however, someone leaked it and the rumors began. Who cares? The government can always deal with rumors. But now these four other guys, two of them are still at large, the situation is so insecure, JFK cancels his visit. The investigation continues. Literally hundreds of Cubans and Mexicans in Chicago are contacted in the next week, hoping to pin down information. In the middle of the investigation, a separate group is suspected in New Orleans on November 17th. What the hell is going on? How many guys are out there trying to kill him? How many teams? What kind of money is behind them? What's the organization? They never encountered anything remotely sophisticated, professional, and persistent. They just couldn't cope with it. Just 5 days later, their protectee was gunned down at noon. The ground shook under the feet of every Secret Service man. Hoover sat back and smiled at their incompetence. Out of the smoke and screams emerges the fall guy, Lee Harvey Oswald. Like an embarrassed police department looking to wrap up their case and quickly hang the culprit's head on a pike for all to see, Oswald was seized upon. As their messiah, the man who would take all the hate, all the blame. Then, before he could speak, they crucified him in the basement of the Dallas police station. How many millions reeled in horror? Yes, but how many dozens in the government realized they had in fact been saved? Like all other cover-ups before and after, the small omissions, deletions, distortions, extractions begot larger and larger crimes. Until, like a powerful man trying to cover up a petty burglary, all the resources available were subtly used to stonewall. To stonewall in so massive a way that the edifice began tumbling down out of sheer size. Then came rushed and nervous support to patch up the cracks. Far more than Watergate, it was the biggest betrayal of the American people in their history. Its dimensions may never be known, but even the little we can see is awesome. And damn it, it's still going full speed. Gerald Ford, who sat in the original Warren Commission, refuses to take another look. Ken Lynch and Thomas B. Cole are sitting there in Washington, afraid to answer questions, afraid to give at least indications, preferring instead to adopt Goebbels tactics of harassing the investigators rather than responding to the investigation. If anyone wants to find out the truth, if anyone wants to disprove that there was a conspiracy to kill JFK in Chicago 20 days before Dallas, it's easy. 1. Show us the teletypes received by the Chicago office during the week of November 2nd. There are only a few. 2. Give us the case titles on every CO file, any investigation controlled directly by the Secret Service Chief's Office in Washington that originated the week of November 2nd. 3. Have Motto, Stocks, Martineau, and Strong submit to a polygraph examination. That's all. Just those three things, and the Secret Service can prove all this is nonsense. Just some disgruntled sources within their own ranks. Just some journalist in Chicago trying to make a name for himself. Okay, smart guys? Prove the conspiracy never happened. We have some of your own guys who swear it did. They swear that it was just a chance, split-second decision that kept Kennedy from actually flying to Chicago, that kept Thomas Arthur Vallée from falsely becoming one of history's lone assassins because he worked in a well-located warehouse, fit a convenient personality stereotype, split seconds from the world remembering Chicago as the place they killed the President of the United States. Edwin Black is a coordinating writer of Chicago Independent. This article from 1975. So there you have it, Edwin Black detailing, and what a great investigative reporter he was, detailing how he investigated the Chicago plot, the plot to kill, assassinate John F. Kennedy on November 2nd, and how it was narrowly avoided. And of course, the other attempts. I hope you enjoyed it.